Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
I've asked my staff to tape record some statements people made when I campaigned at Price's Corner Shopping Mall.
Do you believe politicians when they tell you something in an election year?
No.
Most of the time, no.
No comment.
That's what we've come to. Politicians have done such a job on the people that the people don't believe them anymore. And I'd like a shot at changing that.
A 29-year-old Joe Biden in 1972. A half century and three runs for the White House later, President Joe Biden gave his first speech before a joint session of Congress last night. Quote, "We all know life can knock us down," Biden said, "but in America, we never, ever stay down. Americans always get up." Well, time and again in his long career, Biden has returned to this theme, working for the American people, helping the nation get up. For example, in 1987, during his first presidential run.
"We are in a position, as a nation and as a generation, to make a significant contribution to making things better for ourselves and for our people, and also for what in fact is true, the United States, which is the last best hope for free women and men throughout the world."
But of course, as the decades passed, Biden grew out of his posture in the youthful vanguard. And by 2020, in the presidential race, he positioned himself as something different.
"Look, I view myself as a bridge, not as anything else."
But a bridge to what? Well, in the trio of massive bills he has proposed as president, and as he outlined in detail to Congress last night, Biden made clear that the view from the bridge he's building? A sweeping agenda for an expansive government.
100 days since I took the oath of office and lifted my hand off our family Bible and inherited a nation, we all did, that was in crisis. The worst pandemic in a century. The worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. The worst attack on our democracy since the Civil War. Now, after just 100 days, I can report to the nation, America is on the move again.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today on Point, 100 days, taking the measure of President Joe Biden, the man, and his FDR-sized ambitions. And joining us today is Shayla Murray. She served as Deputy Chief of Staff and Communications Director to then Vice President Joe Biden from 2011 to 2015. She's now Executive Vice President for Public Affairs at Columbia University. Shayla, welcome to On Point.
Oh, hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Amy Parnes, co-author of the new book, Lucky, How Joe Biden Barely Won the Presidency, and senior correspondent as well for The Hill. Amy, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Shayla, I want to start with you, since you worked with President Biden closely for so many years. What Joe Biden did you see last night as he gave his speech to the joint session of Congress?
Well, I saw a person who had reached the summit and isn't going to waste the moment. I think he is faced with a set of challenges that requires the level of energy and ambition that those of us who know Joe Biden know that he brings to generally everything he does. And I think the job has sort of adjusted to, this notion of being a bridge from the Trump era, I think was maybe the way people looked at it a year or so ago, or pre-pandemic. But in the experiences this country has had over the past year has, I think, served up Joe Biden exactly the moment that he's been waiting for a while now.
Okay. Well, you know, what's so interesting to me that, especially the first half of the speech, or maybe even the first two thirds, it was full of policy, right? I saw some folks talking about it afterwards last night, calling it this sort of festival of wonkishness. But frequently then, Biden would interject these moments of humanity, right? I clearly remember the time where he talked about seeing, you know, the images of cars lined up for miles in the midst of the worst parts of the unemployment crisis that came with the pandemic, and people waiting for food. And he said, "I don't know about you, but I never thought I'd see that again in the United States." So can you talk about that a little bit, Shayla? Like how much of how core is that reflection and that connection that he was clearly trying to make to Americans watching in the midst of all the policy talk that he presented to Congress?
I just think he has.
Shayla? Okay, we're going to try and get him back, get Shayla back, excuse me. But Amy Parnes, let me turn to you, and I'll just start with the first question I threw to Shayla. What Joe Biden did you see on the in Congress last night? Was it the same one, the same version of the man that we saw running for president in 2020?
It was. I mean, it was the empathetic Joe Biden. It was the empathizer in chief Joe Biden, who people love. I think that was one of the reasons why he was elected, because people wanted sort of that soothing touch after 4 years of Donald Trump, a tumultuous 4 years. People wanted a return to normalcy. Joe Biden campaigned on that return to normalcy. And you saw exactly that last night. You saw that empathetic Joe Biden talk about, you know, the pain. He understands pain, he knows pain. And I think he kind of reached into that a little bit to kind of show that he understands what people have gone through during this really rough year. And that's sort of why he has had such a successful 100 days, I think, because, you know, he started with the COVID relief package. He proved to Democrats that he wasn't going to be the guy they thought he was, that he was, you know, he campaigned on saying that he was going to reach across the aisle. And he's pleased Democrats by kind of his go it alone attitude, that if Republicans won't cooperate, he will act, because he is wasting no time. And so we saw images of all of those things last night.
Oh, interesting. And Shayla, I think we have you back.
Yes.
Okay.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Sorry about that. Do you want to pick up where Amy just left off there? Because President Biden did speak directly several times to members of the Republican Party. Is the way that he's approaching, you know, what his view of bipartisanship now consistent with how he did when you worked with him during his vice presidency?
Yes, I think that he sees. I think this distinction that he's making now is a meaningful one, because it was a mystery to many. Well, it wasn't a mystery. It was frustrating and ongoing frustration during the Obama years that many of the ideas, the policy ideas that the president was advocating were popular with the American people, but were just finding no purchase among Republicans. I mean, background checks for guns is a perfect example of that. I think that there is, I think Joe Biden learned a lot from those 8 years on the kind of the other side, the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, where he saw this Republican Party that he felt he knew and certainly respected many of his fellow Republican senators over the years and you know, forged friendships with them and alliances on specific bills, but saw a party that had moved in a totally different direction. And I think that what he's trying to do now is communicate directly with voters who feel like that has that they don't have a voice with this Republican Party in Washington anymore, and that they have the same needs, whether it's related to childcare, whether they're also concerned about those cars they see lined up at those food pantries. They also want a public health infrastructure that works more effectively. They see, you know, the bridges and roads and the, you know, all of the energy transition need. I mean, there's so many concrete policy or issues that I think America that unite a lot of Americans, including Republicans, and those, and they're just not represented by the Republican Party in Washington right now.
Right.
And so I think he is able to cut through that, or he's trying to cut through that and create a forge a bond with these voters to build momentum behind some of these very ambitious ideas that he has.
Well, let's just listen to another moment from last night's speech, really talking about the vast inequalities that were made worse during the pandemic. And here's what he said.
650 people increased their wealth by more than $1 trillion during this pandemic. And they're now worth more than $4 trillion. My fellow Americans, trickle down. Trickle down economics has never worked. And it's time to grow the economy from the bottom and the middle out.
Amy Parnes, you know, there's been a lot of writing recently, and I mentioned it even at the top of the show about Biden trying to craft his presidency in the mold of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But we've just about a minute and a half here before we take our first break. I wonder if that's not the right analogy. Perhaps maybe he's more the anti-Ronald Reagan.
I think that's right. I mean, I do think that a lot of people inside the White House and maybe some Democrats like to liken this to FDR, but it is a slightly different circumstance. And I think FDR did have more wind at his back and support to do those things. And, you know, he put forth many more, much more legislation than Biden has. But I do feel like Biden campaigned on the middle class, and he is sort of demonstrating the fact that he is this guy who is going to kind of advocate for the middle class. And I think we saw that last night. I think that was like proof in the pudding that he was going to do that. And that's sort of where we are. And I think we're going to hear much more of that in the weeks to come as he's selling this package across the country.
Well, Amy Parnes and Shayla Murray, stand by here. We'll be back in just a minute. We are talking about President Joe Biden as he reaches the 100-day mark in his presidency. We're taking a measure of the man and his ambitions during his time in the White House as well. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about President Joe Biden in his first 100 days. We're taking a measure of the man and also the ambitions he has for his presidency. I'm joined today by Shayla Murray. She served as Deputy Chief of Staff and Communications Director for then Vice President Biden between 2011 and 2015, served also as a senior advisor to President Obama, and she's now Executive Vice President for Public Affairs at Columbia University. Amy Parnes joins us as well, co-author with Jonathan Allen of the new book Lucky: How Joe Biden Barely Won the Presidency. And let's listen to another moment from Biden's speech before that joint session of Congress last night. And here he's talking about what he's calling the American jobs plan.
These are good paying jobs that can't be outsourced. Nearly 90% of the infrastructure jobs created in an American jobs plan do not require a college degree. 75% don't require an associate's degree. The American Jobs Plan is a blue-collar blueprint to build America. That's what it is.
Joining us now is Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, joining us as always from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, welcome to the show.
Hello, Meghna.
So talk about that moment and a little bit more about what you heard last night from Biden.
Well, that was a Scranton Joe talking, I think. And, you know, I'm hearing, I'm getting feedback on this. I don't know why, but I'll prevail. Your note, I think, struck me as the right one, the anti-Reagan, because strikingly, the only thing more popular than the policies he's called for and spoke for last night are the taxes needed to pay for them. A recent morning consult poll found that if you told voters that if you outlined the infrastructure plan and then said and the wealthy and corporations will pay for this, their support for the infrastructure went up. In other words, taxes under the Reagan aegis were that was the kiss of death for the Democrats. They were just defensive for 35 years. Biden, moved by such polls and partly by his own pollster, John Anzalone, who found out that it was actually popular to talk about taxing rich people and corporations, more popular even than just than the programs. So Biden is the anti-Reagan in that vital respect, and he is a bridge, if you will, to take his party out of the what others have called the defensive crouch they've been in over taxes for a generation.
Jack, so we're going to work on that technical problem, and hopefully it's going to get better very soon. But Shayla Murray, let me turn back to you. Your response to Jack on that, because I know you've said that Biden, one of the things that actually defines him is that he's a remarkably adaptable politician who has been able to, you know, change as circumstances change. And in fact, that by temperament and life experience, he was maybe accidentally calibrated to the amount of change that the country has been going through very recently in the past year. Talk more about that.
So I think one of the most striking things about President Biden is his ability to remain sort of at ground level, even though he has spent, you know, almost the entirety of his life in national politics. And by that, I mean, he is just fundamentally sees things from kind of a middle class dad perspective. And the way he talks about jobs, the way he talks about paychecks, the way he talks about the dignity of work, those are through lines that extend all the way back to his earliest days as a politician. And they certainly inform his view of virtually everything he's talking about today, including in the clips that you just played. I think that when I say adaptive, I mean it in the context of the way real people live their lives. Mm. As you grow and you have different experiences and you're in different phases of life, you adjust your thinking accordingly. And we've seen this with Biden throughout his career. I think we saw it prominently with gay marriage during the Obama years. That for many people, it was sort of received by the Washington Press Corps as a sort of Biden changing positions. I think for a lot of people, that reminded them of the family member or the friend who was going through the exact same kind of personal evolution on that issue. So there are other issues on the table right now. For instance, the police reform bill that he talked about last night in George Floyd's name. I mean, this is a Democrat who has been very closely aligned with police officers throughout his career, is very dedicated to first responders and union members. Mm-hmm. But sees the country changing and is changing along with that country in the sense that he understands this in a different context than he did 30 years ago. And I think the big issue on the table right now is that everyone's least favorite word in Washington, and that is the filibuster, because it's so hard to explain to people, but it is so essential to this entire discussion and to really ultimately the success of his presidency. Because as long as the Senate is so closely divided, it's going to be very hard to, I mean, it's a lot more popular to talk about raising taxes on rich people right now. We'll see if it's a lot easier to vote for tax increases. And that's where the filibuster comes in.
Well, so Amy Parnes, let me turn to you because I just want to note that Senator Tim Scott, in his Republican response last night after President Biden spoke, noted that Democrats used the filibuster last year to block the previous version of that police reform bill. We could talk a lot about more about that in another show. But what I wanted to ask you, Amy, is I hear what Shayla's saying about adaptability in the real world context, you know, like all of us living our lives. And I appreciate that. But in the political context, I mean, can't, and especially given Biden's career, 50-year-long career, that can also be seen as a man who's demonstrated that, you know, does he have malleable principles? You know, because if memory serves me correctly, it's not as if he was a huge champion for making massive changes to healthcare until he kind of had to because the Obama administration put that at the center of its definition of success for President Obama's first term.
Right. I know. And that's part of the problem. We saw that on the campaign. And I think actually on the campaign, he was very true to himself. I think when a lot of people inside internally were trying to budge him and move him left or move him in another direction, the people around him said, no, he's not going to go for that. Because the one thing we saw during the campaign is that he kind of stuck to his principles and he stuck to his guns and didn't move much on the issues. I'm curious to see how that evolves, how this all continues to evolve. I think that he has pleased a lot of Democrats in the first 100 days by actually advocating for their issues, by kind of showing force against Republicans and saying, I'm not going to wait for you guys. I'm a man on a mission and I'm going to take care of business if you're with me or you're not with me. So I'm curious to see how this all plays out. Someone who has a massive Rolodex of contacts on the Hill, who knows better than anyone almost in Washington how this game is played, how he is able to, how he's able to continue. His first 100 days were very successful, but, other presidents have seen a very very successful first 100 days, Carter, for instance, President Carter, and then they've gone downhill. So I'm curious to see how he uses these levers of power going forward in the next few years. But I think he demonstrated that he is not a transitional president last night, that he has an agenda. He has a really ambitious agenda, and he was kind of alerting everyone to look out.
Right. So, Jack, I know that there's observations or questions you had about Joe Biden, the man, as we saw him during the 8 years of the Obama presidency, and really sort of essential insights into his character, which might help us understand how how he views himself in the presidency.
Yes, and maybe Amy, who's just written a book on this, could add some context to this. Joe Biden, throughout his life, has been very sensitive on the subject of his grades, of his schooling, of not being from the Ivy League. In fact, in an eloquent moment in his life, talking to friends, he said, there is a river of power in America, and those who are born in it swim along with it, and it carries them forward. That river flows from the Ivy League. In the Obama administration, he was surrounded by such people. And I think we heard Scranton Joe last night, not worried about what the faculty lounge is going to say, and shaking off some of that touchiness he's had about his own credentials, which don't matter a darn. What matters and what clearly got him the election is his heart, his decency, his compassion. People didn't care about his grades. And finally, I think he's been able to drop that. What do you think about that, Sheila and Amy?
I do agree with you. I do think that I think I mentioned this earlier, but I think that Scranton Joe was very much on display last night. He was very true to his roots. He very much talked about middle class values, single moms. He knows what it's like to be a single dad. He's the one that traveled back to Wilmington every night to be with his sons. So he understands sort of what people are going through right now. And he let that kind of shine last night. And I think that's why it was a pretty powerful speech.
Shayla, you want to respond?
Sure. I think Scranton Joe is just Joe Biden. And I don't think he has different personas. I think the same guy walks into every room he's in. And I think that's what people ultimately identified in the long primary process was someone who is a real person and is consistent in his principles. I mean, I think there's a huge difference between evolving on an issue and your core principles. I don't think Joe Biden's core principles have ever changed or wavered. In fact, I think the way that he's been tested throughout his life through tragedy has, you know, it's not just empathy that you learn from grief and suffering. You also gain a fortitude and a sense of yourself and the sense of mission, his willingness to take risks right now, this taking the country to a stronger and bolder place, the instincts that he's showing us, I think are, those are characteristics of someone who's been up to the edge of life's most extreme version of pain and is sort of, I think, transcends it. And that's, I think, in some bizarre way, maybe a gift that Beau gave to his father. But he is certainly a man who is liberated and enlightened in a way that I think, again, going back to this notion of kind of wisdom and experience and what it ultimately gives you. I think that's what we're seeing in this person, a person that we have feel like we've known for a long time, but are continue to see new dimensions of, because again, I think he's a person who's evolving right before our eyes.
Right. You know, the other thing about Joe Biden, the man, is that I think he's commonly known as a voluble guy. He'll shake every hand on the rope line. He wants to meet everyone in the room. He'll flash that smile for any number of selfies, for example. And in fact, we saw a little bit of that after the speech last night. I mean, granted, there was a fraction of the number of people that are usually in the chamber, but he did spend some time shaking hands and talking to members of Congress. That was a familiar Biden. But what's quite interesting to me is that Joe that America knows is different than one aspect of the public persona that he is fashioning as president. And I'm actually going to let Texas Senator Republican Ted Cruz describe what a lot of people have been seeing or thinking about Joe Biden. And here's what Senator Cruz said on Fox News on Wednesday.
I think you can sum up the first 100 days of this presidency, and I think you can sum up the speech that we're going to hear tonight in three words: boring, but radical. I think Joe Biden has made a decision, the Biden White House has made a decision, to be as boring as possible. And you think of it, after 4 years of every day the president driving the news, I think it's probably smart politics on the Biden White House for people to wake up and not ask themselves, what did the president tweet last night? What did he say? This is not a moderate agenda. This is not a unity agenda. This is a radical agenda.
Okay, so Amy, last night, did you catch the camera catching Ted Cruz almost falling asleep?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was a pretty good example of the boring, but you know, in his words, radical. Can you talk about, do you think that there's a really tactical decision going on from the Biden White House about that quote unquote boring part?
I think that, you know, they want to kind of make him invisible. That was part of the whole game plan, I think, to, you know, not make him so much invisible, but to bring the presidency, to make the presidency more normal again. So that Ted Cruz is right. You're not waking up to tweets and, you know, just these salacious statements all day long from people, from the president. So I think that's sort of one of the goals. But he has been remarkably scripted, I've noticed. You don't have these so-called Uncle Joe moments that people were expecting. He has been remarkably disciplined in kind of staying on message in, you know, taking questions, but not, I think last night was he delivered more off the cuff than we have seen. But I think more generally, he's been very scripted and very disciplined and has kind of been a different person, I think, in the White House. I think he understands the gravity and the seriousness, obviously, of the office he's in, but also in the moment and the time that people are suffering. And so we've seen kind of a very serious, deliberate Joe Biden, I think. And I'm curious to see how this continues to play out. But I think that's one of the reasons why his first 100 days have been so successful, because he kind of has brought back that sense of normalcy. And he has made the president kind of invisible again, and has made, you know, I think he said, you're not going to, or someone said on the campaign, you're not going to, you're not going to read about me every day, or you're not going to want to hear what's going on in the White House every day. And that's sort of where Joe Biden is right now.
Well, Amy Parnes and Jack Beatty, just stand by here for a second. Shayla Murray, I've got to let you go. Shayla served as Deputy Chief of Staff and Communications Director for then Vice President Joe Biden between 2011 and 2015, and is now Executive Vice President for Public Affairs at Columbia University. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a look at President Biden at 100 days, taking a measure of the man and his ambitions for his presidency. I'm joined today by Amy Parnes. She's co-author of the new book, along with Jonathan Allen. The book is Lucky: How Joe Biden Barely Won the Presidency, also senior correspondent for The Hill. Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst, is with us as well. And, you know, a little earlier, we did raise the specter of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And that's for a reason, because across from the Resolute desk in the Oval Office, there hangs a portrait of the 32nd president of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And while preparing to take office, Biden did look to FDR's legacy as a guide. He even went so far as to say, quote, "I'm kind of in the position FDR was in." And in fact, Biden drew inspiration from books on FDR, including The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope by journalist Jonathan Alter.
First of all, I'm thrilled that he read my book. And I think it just reflects his sense that he has something to learn from Franklin Roosevelt at this moment in history.
It's no coincidence, Alter says, that Biden's chief of staff, Ron Klain, is taking to quoting Roosevelt's 1933 inauguration speech.
Restoration calls, however, not for changes in ethics alone. This nation is asking for action, and action now.
Alter also told us that it's clear Biden is emulating Roosevelt's moves to act quickly in his first 100 days.
What Roosevelt did is in his first 100 days, he put a couple hundred thousand people to work. And Biden, in his first 100 days, vaccinated more than 200 million people. And so the you know, comparison, I think, is most vivid when it comes to government being responsive and feeling that you can't just sit back.
And he adds that the core of Biden's plans mirrors FDR's New Deal in that government needs to be thinking big about jobs and infrastructure.
Better the occasional fault of a government that lives in a spirit of charity than the consistent omissions of a government frozen in the ice of its own indifference.
We can't do too much here. We can do too little. We can do too little and sputter. But again, the end result is it's not just the macroeconomic impact on the economy and our ability to compete internationally. It's people's lives.
And the reason that going big is possible, Alter says, is that both Biden and Roosevelt held majorities in Congress, although in Biden's case, it is a microscopic majority. For the Biden administration, that points back to January 5th. Alter says when Democrats gained the seats it needed in Georgia to grab that majority.
The results of January 5th had gone the other way. We would now be looking at the government investing less than $1 trillion in the American economy, with the results of January 5th, in all likelihood, we will be investing more than $4 trillion in our economy by the middle of this year.
That's Jonathan Alter, author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days, and the Triumph of Hope. And Jonathan Alter also told us that by that measure, he believes that January 5th may be as pivotal a moment in U.S. history as January 6th, of course, the day of the insurrection. But of course, nothing is guaranteed. Biden will have to hang on to every single vote he can get in Congress. And to that end, Alter also recently wrote in the New York Times that character will be a deciding factor in determining Biden's success or failure, as it was with FDR. And this is absolutely fascinating because Alter wrote, quote, "Meeting Mr. Roosevelt was like, as Winston Churchill said, opening your first bottle of champagne. And meeting Mr. Biden is like one's first encounter with a tail-wagging therapy dog." But he makes this point that the X factor, quote, "then and now, in moving legislation is the temperament of the president. Does he have the schmooze gene that can help him win those last crucial votes?" Now, Jack, how much do you think the temperament of Joe Biden is going to be central to the success of his policy agenda? Or are there bigger forces at play that could overcome, you know, the temperament of a Biden or a Roosevelt here in 2021 America?
Well, there's the pressure of time. Dan Baltz mentions that today in the Washington Post. At 78, Joe Biden has to be in a hurry. He also has to be in a hurry for another reason, the midterm elections. Indeed, he's got to govern to win those elections. Democracy may depend on it. For consider, if the Republicans capture the House, they're only five seats away. The people who rejected the results of the 2020 election will be in place to reject the results of the 2024 election. This time, they'll have the power to prevail. The GOP is signaling it's ready to scrap what Lincoln called the majority principle and install minority rule. Biden, to save democracy, he really's got to set aside bipartisanship to get Democrats fired up and ready to vote in the midterms. Obama's coalition in 2008, we remember, melted away in 2010. The fate of the president's party in 19 of the last 21 midterms. That's the political gravity Biden must defy in 2022. Only once before have the stakes, majority versus minority rule, been so high in the election of 1860.
1860, Jack. That is what is at stake?
Well, there was a party that was not ready to accept the results of the election of 1860 and seceded over that. They weren't going to bow to the will of the majority. And that is the issue that the Republican Party in its current radical phase is presenting to us. Can this party ever be trusted in power without purging itself of its subversive, seditious Trumpian obsessions?
Mm. Well, Amy Parnes, first of all, respond to that. What do you think about Jack's analysis in terms of the gravity of the situation regarding the position of the Republican Party?
Oh, I completely agree with Jack. And I do agree also that he is a man in a hurry right now because he sees 2022 around the corner, and it is. He knows that his party has control right now, and he's desperately trying to do what it takes to reverse some things that Trump has done, but also to implement his own policies before 2022 and before things could reverse. But yes, I think the Republican Party is still kind of they're finding their way, and they are lost right now, and they are trying to throw everything at President Biden possible. You had this hamburger debate this week. And I think that they're going to continue to throw whatever they can and see whatever sticks, because they don't have so much as a leader. They have Donald Trump, and that's about it. And they're still trying to find their way and climb their way back to 2022. And they also have to, they're in a hurry too. They have to kind of turn things around very quickly if they want to win back the House and the Senate.
Mm. I mean, but you just wrote a piece in The Hill saying that that partisan divides are worse now, 100 days in, than they even were when Biden took the oath of office.
Exactly. Things are baked in and no one is moving. And that's why Biden is more reliant on people like Joe Manchin more than ever, because he needs every single vote in the party. And Joe Manchin kind of is digging his heels in the ground right now, the senator from West Virginia. And he's saying, look, I'm not going to do anything. We have to act in a bipartisan way. This is what our nation was founded upon. We have to work together. So I'll be interested in seeing how President Biden greases those wheels, and how we talked about, does he have that kind of schmooze factor? He is very schmoozy, and he does know a lot of people, and he does make calls. He picks up calls and talks to people. He talked to Joe Manchin throughout the gun legislation debate, for instance. And so he's a man that's known to do that. He's different than Barack Obama, President Obama, in that way, who didn't really like that that element of the presidency, who didn't really like you know, he was always the first one out of the room when it came to schmoozing with people in the other party. But I think President Biden has learned a lot from his time as vice president under Barack Obama. And he knows that he has to play things a little differently if he is to avoid what happened in 2010 when President Obama called the shellacking of the Democratic Party.
Well, I do wonder what a president can do, or how they can navigate a situation in which one party has made it clear, absolutely crystal clear, that it's not going to offer any votes for a president's plan. Now, certainly there's the spirit of compromise, perhaps, because you actually heard Biden trying to reach in that direction a couple of times last night in his speech, even to the point where he almost apologized. It seems apologized for bringing things up. Not really, but he tried to tamp it down. I mean, here, for example, when he talked about the epidemic of gun violence, here's what Biden said.
I don't want to become confrontational, but we need more Senate Republicans to join the overwhelming majority of Democratic colleagues and close the loopholes required in background check purchases of guns. We need a ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. And don't tell me it can't be done. We did it before and it worked.
Jack Beatty, though, I wonder, I mean, what I hear Joe Biden talking about the potential for a bipartisan agreement over these extremely confrontational or contentious issues. But given what you described in Republican leadership, in the Republican Party, what does bipartisanship even mean in this context?
Well, indeed, it may mean just these sort of feckless verbal gestures toward it. You know, I get back to the picture you were drawing of Biden, of a man evolving, changing. He's got to evolve and change on this. The Senate, where he came to manhood, where he political manhood, that doesn't exist anymore. The party system that was then formed doesn't exist anymore. He's in a new moment. And in this moment, bipartisanship, it would mean surrender effectively to the Republicans. They'd be happy if he embraced their infrastructure bill, for example, but it's a quarter or a third of what his is. And so that would be to say, well, what I promised the electorate, I have to abandon because I need bipartisan. He doesn't need bipartisanship if he can get things through on under reconciliation, or if he can suspend the filibuster. And in both of those, Joe Manchin is the effective prime minister of the country. He will decide there.
I saw the camera occasionally caught Manchin taking notes during Biden's speech last night. I think Mitt Romney also had a notebook in front of him taking notes as well. It's not something I'd actually seen before in one of these speeches before Congress. But Amy Parnes, let me ask you, I do wonder if, you know, the Republicans are talking about Biden. You heard in that clip earlier from Ted Cruz about, in their words, a bait and switch. In a sense, is that actually right, that Biden, per Jack's point, is going to be talking this bipartisan game, but because of the urgency that you've both described he's feeling— And in fact, he pretty much said this last night. He's like, you've got to come along with us because we don't have time. And if they don't, he's just going to drive ahead as fast as he can.
Yeah, I think the difference with Joe Biden is that throughout the campaign and throughout his whole legacy, really, he has been that guy to reach across party lines and to work with the other party. And he was always a centrist. And that was something that scared a lot of Democrats. A lot of Democrats didn't want to vote for him because of that. They felt like as soon as he was elected, he would be the guy marching to Capitol Hill and striking deals and going against his own party. But we've seen the opposite happen. I think in the first 100 days, he has been a champion of his own party and has welcomed his party. And you saw him kind of talk to Bernie Sanders right after he left the stage last night, which I think was a pretty significant moment. And he's kind of welcomed and embraced that wing of the party. So I'm curious to see how he's able to kind of do his delicate dance and help his own party and yet strike deals with Joe Manchin and with moderate Republicans like Susan Collins, and how he's able to do that. I think if anyone has the ability to do that, it is President Biden.
We've just got about a minute and a half left, Jack, and you know, who knows what's going to happen in the coming days, weeks, and months. But, you know, Joe Biden he's looking to the horizon and he sees 80, right? he sees 80. So even though it's only been the first 100 days of his presidency, you've got to think that legacy is on his mind already as well.
Oh, it can't but be. I mean, this is the inexorable pressure, the existential pressure of being 78 years old. And also, I think the sense that he's got to get it in this, whatever he's doing has to happen this year, to get them into a good position for 2022. That's behind everything. And this, you know, what looks like profligacy, trillion here, trillion there, all the trillions are in aid of getting the Democrats over that 2022 midterms, because if the economy is booming, they'll have a chance. Otherwise, they're fighting the tides of history, and the record is not hopeful there.
Well, Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, thank you, Jack, as always.
Thank you.
And Amy Parnes, co-author with Jonathan Allen of the new book, Lucky, How Joe Biden Barely Won the Presidency, and also a senior correspondent for The Hill newspaper. Amy, it was great to have you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.